This week on Family Anatomy, anatomy of three things.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And we are talking once again about three things, three news stories from the familyanatomy.com website. We tend to do this at the end of every month, right? That's been our pattern generally.
Three things from the website.
Three things. Three very important, very interesting stories from our website.
I thought we were going to talk about three personal things from your life.
Oh, okay. Let's get on with that then.
Okay, go ahead.
No. Okay. Let's start with story number one. Let's get right into it.
All right, let's do that.
How about we go that route instead? Okay, the first one is a story that I wrote on, I think, September 10th, so earlier in the month. And it's called, Do Depressed Moms Have Depressed Kids?
Even the title by itself probably scares a lot of people. Just that title, you're going, oh man, you know, so if I get depressed, I bet you if I read on, it's going to be, boy, my kids are going to be depressed.
Well, this is a concern. It's a concern for, I think it's a concern for parents, not just moms, right? I mean, depression is more common in women than in men still, I think. But when you're depressed, what are the symptoms of depression? It's not just feeling sad. It's also losing enjoyment in things you used to like. It might affect your appetite, your sleep, your concentration. There's all kinds of things. And these are things that don't just affect you. If you're part of a family unit, they can have ripple effects all through your house, right?
It's terrible to think, you know, because it's true. And so like a depressed person who's already feeling terrible about themselves,
yeah,
also has to consider this extra burden that there's people around them that are being affected too in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's another thing for them to be depressed about, really.
It might be an added level, of course. But if you read through the whole story, you'll find out that there were a few things that might be a little bit surprising, okay? So what these guys did, and one of the reasons why I thought this story was kind of interesting, is that the study followed moms from 1 month after the birth of their child up until the child was 15 years. So this is a long-term commitment that these families have made.
It's a solid study, too, to think that it's 15 years of research, really.
They're trying to see if there's anything that's going to predict adjustment of the teenagers. The other thing that's kind of neat about it is that many of these studies will get reports from teachers or reports from parents about how the kids are doing. But this one actually has the adolescents report themselves on things like their behavior, their mood, their reactions to stress, things like that. Okay? So what they found was that they were able to divide the moms up into a few different groups. And they found that the moms who were reporting chronic depressive symptoms, so these are moms who are having a clinical level, you might call it, of depression that was stable over time. So for those 15 years, they were often feeling really, really low. Well, the researchers found that those moms had kids who reported more feelings of sadness themselves, more what they call internalizing kinds of problems, which are things like worry and sad mood and social withdrawal and stuff like that. They also found that moms who reported stable but subclinical levels of depression. So they were reporting some depressive symptoms that were there over time. They were stable over time, but they didn't reach that level that we would call the clinical cutoff.
Just to give people an idea, there's 9 symptoms that psychologists and psychiatrists look for, and you need 5 of these 9 symptoms. So subclinical would be that you had 4, 3, 2, 1 of these symptoms.
Right, right. But these are things that are stable for these moms, and they found that the moms with stable subclinical depressive symptoms also had kids who reported more of their own depressive symptoms and internalizing than moms who were never depressed.
So even the subclinical group, these moms with the subclinical depression, they still had the same kind of negative impact on their kids as the depressed moms.
Exactly. Even in cases where the symptoms were, you might call them relatively mild, you know, compared to a mom who has a clinical depression, these moms' symptoms were less than that, but their kids were still reporting more problems than moms who were never depressed.
Okay, now before people turn off the podcast and go away with a bad feeling about this entire enterprise, tell them what happens next.
Okay, well, there are 2 things that kind of add maybe a silver lining to this dark cloud that we've been talking about. The first is that moms who were depressed when their kids were younger, but their symptoms got better, well, those kids weren't any different at 15 years old from the moms who were never depressed. The kids of moms who were never depressed, okay? So, and this was even though the moms whose depression was worse at the beginning and then got a bit better, their overall level of depression was higher than those in that stable subclinical group that we talked about before. So even though their symptoms were greater, because they started out worse and got better, for some reason those kids were reporting higher levels or better adjustment than the kids whose moms had those stable symptoms.
And here is, to me, this is what it tells me. If you're a depressed mom, you're never too depressed or too late to get some help, and in that way, not just help yourself, but also the people around you, and particularly your kids.
Exactly, and that's what I was thinking. The other thing that came to my mind was that somehow these moms are they're getting at least a little bit better, and maybe their kids are learning something from that. Maybe somehow they're learning, they're picking up some coping strategies or something, whatever it was that the moms did to help them feel even a little bit better, maybe the kids are picking that up, and that's why they don't differ from the kids of moms who weren't depressed at all.
I've seen a lot of kids, teens in particular, who one of their fears is that there's some sort of destiny there.
Right.
That this happened to a member of my family, and it's almost like this thing's going to come after them and envelop them as well. And they feel there's some kind of inevitability to it.
Mm-hmm.
When the story ends differently, that the parent's getting better, that inevitability feeling, that feeling that you don't have control over this thing that will take you over, goes away to some extent, because you can see it's a different phenomenon.
Exactly. And what might be the best news, I guess, out of all of this is that when you sit down and you look at the tables, you look at the data in this study, what you find is that even the parents of the most, or the children of the most depressed moms were reporting depressive symptoms and internalizing problems that were within the normal range.
That's the part of the study that I'm having trouble with. Can you clarify that?
Okay. And this is something that took me a minute to wrap my head around, because I looked at the tables with the numbers and I was scratching my head saying, well, none of these kids are depressed.
Right. So what are they talking about?
Well, what they're saying is that the kids whose moms were depressed are reporting more difficulties, but even those difficulties were still within the normal range for 15-year-olds.
So why are we so concerned about this equation to the moms who are depressed if it's just normal for 15-year-olds?
Well, it's normal for 15-year-olds, but they were having more trouble. So the averages, when you take the average over all of the kids, the average scores came out within the normal range. Okay? But they were still having a bit more trouble than the kids whose moms weren't depressed at all. So there was a link there, but that prophecy, that destiny that the kids, that the teens that you've talked to were talking about, really it's not there. You might not feel quite as good as your friend whose mom has never been depressed, but you're not depressed yourself necessarily, and you might be on the high end of normal, but you're still pretty normal for a 15 year old.
So that's what it is. It's on the high end of normal is the way we want to think of that.
I think probably that's the best way to think of it, is that it's on the higher end of normal. So mom's depression might be having some impact on their kids over time when it's that stable kind of depression that's persistent over, and we're talking over a decade. So you're feeling pretty low for over a decade. It has a bit of an impact on your kid's mood, but it's not necessarily, now obviously we can't make broad generalizations, it's not necessarily setting the destiny, setting the path that your kids are going to follow over time. That doesn't mean it's not important to get help, though.
Right. Doesn't mean it's not important to get help, but that burden that I was talking about at the beginning of this segment isn't there, really.
So I think for that reason, the study is important. You need to sit down and think about that. Okay, well, maybe there's some impact.
But it's not another reason for you to be depressed.
But it's not another reason. It shouldn't add to a parent's worries, maybe. But maybe it might be worth maybe raising a red flag to say, boy, if I get help, then my kids are going to be just exactly like everybody else, and they'll feel even better.
Right.
So there you go.
So that's study thing number one.
The first thing.
Go to, I thought it was number two. Are we ready for thing? Yeah, it's sure. It's interesting.
Tell me about thing number two. I feel like we're reading The Cat in the Hat.
That's true.
Thing number one and thing number two.
Dr. Seuss, and you can be Dr. Seuss. How about that?
Sure.
All right. I'll be Dr. Spisano. All right. So second thing, second study. Can Viagra improve your relationship? This is something that I posted just recently on the website, familyanatomy.com.
Right.
Viagra, first of all, Viagra was introduced in 1998. It feels like it was yesterday.
You know,
it feels like this new drug, but it's over 10 years now.
Mm-hmm. It's only been recently, maybe in the last couple of years, that I've seen, lots of TV ads. Those funny ads that you get with the dads coming out of that, or the husbands coming out of the house dancing and singing and
here's the funny
around.
Thing. It's true. You see this all. I was watching the news tonight, the CBS Evening News, and there it was. Now, it wasn't Viagra, it was Cialis.
Right.
Same idea.
Same kind of medication.
Yeah. I guess, you know, the demographic is men between 40 and 70, because erectile dysfunction in the U.S. affects about 20 million men.
Right.
It's a big number.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot for the drug company to go after and consider. 20 million.
Sure. That's a lot of customers.
You know, sure. It's a lot of customers. Now, since its inception, 25 million men around the world have tried it.
Wow.
It's a lot of men.
Yeah.
Interesting that only half of the prescriptions that are made get refilled.
So that's not a lot. I mean, that's not a lot when you compare it to the overall number of people who have those prescriptions. But
why is it, though, that only half of them go back?
This is what you were wondering, and this is what you wrote about in your article,
and this
right?
is what I'm writing about, because if you just see the commercials, it looks like everyone should be happy with this drug. It's helping them have
every
a great
drug
sex
commercial.
Life. Sure. Now, this is a particular...
Helping them learn to dance?
Yes, they're doing everything except actually having sex in the commercials, which they can't show. But they're learning, you know, they're dancing, they're smiling, they're, you know, having coffee in the sunshine, you know, they're on the beach. Everything's nice in the commercial. And you don't really hear about the fact that potentially 50% of the time it's not working.
If that's the reason why.
They're not going back to it, is it because they've been cured after the first pill? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So for some reason, they're not going
back to it. It's not having the desired effect, whatever that is.
So, but again, for 50%, it is having the desired effect. Now, what is the effect? Here's the thing. If you watch commercials, by the way, 25 million men around the world, I have not met one that takes this drug. Not one. Not one person has come to me and said, you know, I'm taking...
or you should try this.
That's right.
It's no.
Not, doesn't come personally recommended ever. I don't know. I have not had even one person say to me, yes, I take this. No, there must be people around me that are taking it.
They just don't talk about it.
Now, it is a personal subject. I understand that. But not one time have I had a personal experience with someone saying, I've taken it. So I've never taken it myself. I don't know anyone that's taken it. And yet, there's 25 million men that take it. There's commercials all over the TV. I go to the hockey arena. There's big, on the boards. There's big ads for it.
It's
a phenomenon.
I won't say I'm disappointed to hear that this isn't going to turn into the True Confessions episode of Family Anatomy. So that's okay.
But it's interesting how prevalent it is and yet how cloaked it is at the same time. Anyway, let's get back to what... From the commercials, you're not really going to know what it does. It's not
like
there
most
to tell
of those,
you.
Like most of those drug commercials.
Right.
It's really hard to tell. It just says, ask your doctor about this, whatever it's called.
That's right. And that's true. It's for most commercials. It does tell you the potential side effects because that's by law. That
legally,
they
have to
tell you that. Yep. But they don't really tell you what it does. So I think a lot of people have a misconception. Everybody's heard of Viagra at this point.
Mm-hmm, I think so. Most people, yeah.
But there's a lot of misconceptions. One would naturally be that if you take the pill, maybe it helps your sexual desire.
Sure, yeah, that would be a natural... When you look at the commercials again, that would be a natural...
Conclusion to make.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with sexual desire. No.
It's a physiological...
It might indirectly have something to do with it, because if you're in a situation where you can't get aroused, then... it might diminish your sexual desire because of the anxiety that's caused by that.
Right.
So if you're able to resolve this problem with erectile dysfunction, then it might motivate your sexual desire that way because the fear might go down, let's say.
But here's the thing.
Directly has nothing to do with sexual desire.
Here's the thing. If the problem is psychological, this isn't a medication that's going to help.
It's not going to help.
If it's a physical problem, maybe. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but maybe that's a medication that could be helpful. But it sounds like from what you've written here, if the problem is a psychological one, or if it's a problem in the relationship, this medication is not necessarily going to change anything there.
This medication is strictly to help a physiological issue, which is you're not having enough blood flow to your penis.
Right.
Right, that's what it is. That's a physiological fix.
So what you have is a situation where, through advertising, the drug company has kind of made it maybe semi-acceptable to think about or talk about this kind of treatment. But guess what? Treatment still has that stigma attached to it. It's the therapy that goes along with it. And thinking, and as I was reading this, I was thinking to myself, okay, if I had to go on this medication and then it didn't work, what would be my next step? Could I sit in front of a therapist and talk about this problem? And I'm a therapist.
Right.
It would be hard for me to talk about that.
It would be hard. And that's interesting, though. See, it's much, much easier to take a pill that's completely private, really. I mean, it's just you,
yeah.
A very brief visit to your physician.
You have talked about this almost every time medication has come up on the show, is the idea that it's easier to take the medication than it is necessarily to take the steps or the lifestyle changes or the therapy to make a real lasting change in your life.
Far less threatening. Far less threatening. Now, here's the interesting thing, though. If, and we don't have any research on this, if you take the medication and it doesn't work for you, is it an impetus to turn around and get some therapeutic help? Because now you're sort of into that sort of trajectory of trying to get help for something. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's people who, by the way, I think it's, what is it? I'm trying to get the statistic here. I think it's about 70% of men don't seek out treatment. 70%. So mm-hmm. If you're part of the 30% that have decided to try some treatment, then you would think that when the first one that was less threatening didn't work, you might continue down the road to something more threatening because you're on that road already.
Or does it feel like, oh boy, that you gathered up your courage to take this major step, I think, to talking to, even talking to your doctor about it, even though you see it on the commercials, it might not be a very comfortable thing to talk about, unless maybe you're more extroverted or, yep, or comfortable in that way. But it might be something that's really difficult to talk about. So you finally get up the courage to go in and seek out that treatment, and the treatment didn't work. And oh my gosh, you just feel hopeless.
Yeah. Now, the relationship part of it, the pill's not going to, if you don't feel attracted to your spouse anymore, the pill won't do anything for that. If your spouse is not attracted to you, and that's affecting how you feel in return, it won't help that either. If you're fighting as a couple all the time and that's creating trouble, the pill has nothing to say to that issue. If you're in a situation where there's a lot of performance anxiety, which is a typical thing, before Viagra came along, one of the sort of mainstays of therapy was to reduce performance anxiety in men, because that anxiety redirected blood flow away from the genitals, right, and that was one of the reasons you were having erectile dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
So that, the pill, is not going to help. So, you know, that performance anxiety is something that has to be dealt with.
Relationship problems obviously need to be dealt with. If there's anxiety, this is not a treatment for that. It's not a treatment for your relationship. Although it's possible that in some relationships it might have a positive, it's sort of indirect.
Like I said, it could have a domino sort of effect.
But that's not what the treatment really is meant to do. It's not meant to change your relationship. It's meant to change a certain element maybe within your relationship.
If your relationship is good, if your wife is sexually aroused by you and you by your wife, and the only thing standing in your way is a physiological inability to get enough blood to your genitals, then this works.
But otherwise, you've dispelled some myths today, Dr. Spisano.
One or two.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Let's talk about our third story.
Let's do it.
We're going to talk a little bit about something that you may now be familiar with, now that you have a child who's going into grade one. Just started grade one,
so not quite. I asked him tonight, and he said no, he did not have homework.
It's about homework. Now, my son came home with homework from kindergarten, but that's my son's school is maybe a little bit crazy that way. But the title of this article is homework helpful? And at the beginning of the school year, I was sort of thinking about this again, and there was an article from a few years ago in Maclean's, way back in 2006, but I bought this magazine and I remember reading this article, and lots of the teachers around schools that I would talk to were talking about just this very thing. And I would see this magazine on desks and in schools and all over the place. So it was the cover story of Maclean's magazine, and the cover story was called "Is Homework Killing Kids?" So I guess it's good that teachers would take the time to take a look and see what that had to say. But what this really was an interview with I believe a former teacher. I don't think he's still teaching, but he's also the author of a book. His name is Alfie Cohn, and his book is called The Homework Myth: Why Our Kids Get Too Much of a Bad Thing. And he argues that there is no evidence of any link between homework and academic achievement.
Now, I gotta say, I hadn't looked into that. I had assumed that there was a link, and when I read through your article, he makes some pretty good points. There's not a lot of evidence against what he's saying.
Well, you know what? He sort of, to say that there's no evidence at all that homework is helpful is a bit of a stretch, but the evidence isn't conclusive. And what I did was I went and I did a search after that to see, well, gosh, you know, you would think the conventional wisdom is that homework is helpful, that it teaches you a work ethic, it gives you a review, it helps to reinforce the things that you're learning in class. You would think that all of those things would be true. And then he says, no, there's no evidence. And when I looked, the evidence is a little bit mixed. And you know, one of the things that I found in all of the studies that I read related to homework was that a big thing that sort of interferes with any positive benefits of homework are negative feelings about homework. So for kids and for families where there's a negative attitude and negative feelings about homework, then there wasn't so much of a positive impact. I think some of the studies found that there was a negative impact. The more homework those kids got, the worse they just felt angry about school and unmotivated, I guess, to do the work. But if there were positive feelings about homework, certain kinds of homework might be beneficial, but it wasn't shown conclusively across the board. Okay. What we do know, because we've sat down, we've written on the website, we've talked about it here on the show, is that there are other activities that you can do that have been linked over and over again very conclusively with academic achievement, those extracurriculars.
Co-curricular activities, yes.
Or co-curricular activities. For those who haven't heard the episode, those are also known as extracurricular activities, sports and other things that you might be doing outside of school that might be linked to increased feelings of belongingness in the school community and things like that, increased sense of mastery, increased self-confidence, lots of things that somehow also create a positive impact on the academics. So one wonders if your time might be better spent. I think I wrote in the article, would it be better for teachers to assign kids to a sports team than to assign math homework to bring home?
And it's one of these things where the generalization that he's got is, you know, there's some evidence for what he's saying, because if you say there's mixed evidence for homework being helpful, and then you say there's pretty clear evidence that co-curricular activities or extracurricular activities are good, and that could be taking the place of homework, then, you know, he's making a pretty good point there.
You know,
on the other hand, though, you have to look at the specific situation that you're in. So
right.
If you have a kid who's doing well in school, his thesis here is particularly relevant to you.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
Your kid's doing well in school. Maybe that time after school is better spent doing co-curricular activities, doing just things together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with spending quality time together with your son or daughter instead of trying to get them to do homework, which may or may not make any difference, particularly because they're already doing well.
There
if your kid is
need,
not doing well.
There are some kids who need extra help.
That's it. If yours is one of the children that is a little behind,
mm-hmm.
Well, that might be a different story, that they might need that extra help to try and... Now, it depends, you know, on their... This is what I mean. I guess it gets complicated. Do they have a learning disability? Is that why they're a little further behind?
Right.
Do they have the cognitive ability that's a little lower, which is matching the level at which they're at? It gets more complicated than the generality that he's putting forth as a thesis.
Well, and that's true. But admittedly, there are some kids who might need some extra time and some extra help. However, if you just keep in mind, as parents, maybe as teachers too, who are listening, that it's possible that negative feelings about that kind of work are going to have maybe a bigger negative impact than the actual work itself might have in a positive way, then you might need to be a little bit creative about the way that you do that. Is there a way to get that practice that will also maintain or create or sustain a positive attitude about those kinds of activities? Because, I mean, you and I both know, as psychologists who work with kids who have different kinds of learning styles, that if you're having trouble at school, one of the most important things is going to be your motivation to learn. Because if you need to do some extra work or use some extra strategies or be more organized than the person sitting beside you to get the same work done, you need to feel excited and interested about learning, or else why are you going to do those things?
And this is where it gets so particular. We've both seen kids who are behind other kids in the class, but doesn't seem to bother them at all.
Mm-hmm.
They just keep going. They think they're doing well. They feel good about themselves.
Or they're doing as well as they feel like they need to.
Exactly. And then they do the homework and it's no big deal.
Right.
There's other kids that are like, they're maybe not even behind. Mm-hmm. They're doing well. But they hate homework. They're just bright kids that don't need to work so hard, and they hate doing homework, and there's that negative feeling. So that's something to really consider. How? And then there's the kids who aren't doing well, and they recognize it, and homework is just the last thing they want to do, and there's a lot of negative feelings there. And you're right, that's that's probably the hardest challenge right there.
And there may need to be some professional help, whether that comes from a psychologist who looks to find out if there's a learning disability or some way to use the child's strengths to help them overcome the weaknesses. Maybe it's a tutor who can help the child in a different way than the teachers at school are helping, or address the need or make it fun in that way. Let's be clear, though, that Alfie Cohn isn't saying homework should be eliminated altogether. He also said there's certain kind of homework that really is appropriate. Things like setting aside some time for leisure reading. You know, read a book. That's good practice. And if it's a book that the child chooses, it's even better to maintain that interest in learning and that kind of thing. If there are activities that sort of have to be done at home, my son hasn't quite gotten there yet, but I'm sure you've also heard about those projects where the kids come home and they interview their parents about their job or something about their... We did some interviews about the countries that our families originated from. So that's something you need to talk to a parent or a grandparent about. And those are things that even Mr. Cohn, who's not a big believer in homework, he thinks that those kinds of things are appropriate to do at home.
And I guess the other thing, this was an interesting point that he made, that, you know, if you're doing homework and you're developing critical thinking skills, what is that? We've talked about that in a previous episode where mm-hmm. you're evaluating, you're judging, you're comparing things, you're developing your ability to interpret, make reasoned judgments about something, not just rote kind of work, what he calls busy work.
Right.
Which is interesting because I remember my wife and I, both psychologists, and when we were doing our thesis for our PhD, mm-hmm. it's a long process, it's complicated, it's like writing a book, and there'd be days when your mind just was not on the project, but you knew there was a lot ahead of you and that you had to get it done, and so you might be 4 days, let's say, really working hard and with really critical thinking skills, trying to put things together and make sense out of everything and trying to organize it in a way that there was a flow and a thread through it. And on day five, your brain just couldn't take it anymore and you were doing busy work. And busy work for us was compiling the references at the back of the thesis. So even today, when when our minds are a little exhausted, we'll use that as a short form for, is your mind exhausted or are you still going to do references today?
Oh boy, yeah. Well, and kids have the same thing. I mean, you're talking about a situation where two people who are on their way to a PhD, and there's only so much of that kind of thing that you can do, and so you do need a break. So I think teachers and parents need to consider that as well. And look for some kind of a balance.
Now, because we work in schools, I'm sure you've heard this a number of times, the rule of thumb that they tell people is that you do 10 minutes for every grade level that you're at. So if you're in grade 1, you do 10 minutes, grade 2, 20, etc. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard that lots and lots of times. I'm not sure how that applies to situations where kids are in a French immersion program or they're learning a second language too, because that also adds a level of complexity to it. Does that count things like leisure reading and stuff? I love the idea of just having kids pick out a book and read a book in the evening, because that's, again, we're talking about life skills that you want kids to be able to, you want to nurture in your kids a love of reading, a love of books, because that's the best thing that they're going to bring that with them no matter what job you're in. I would say you're either going to read for pleasure or you're going to have to read the material for your work. It can certainly be a benefit there. I shouldn't say every job you need to read, but it certainly can be something that can be a valuable part of your life.
I would say for the majority of jobs you need to read, and for a minority you need mathematics.
Oh, there's also that.
Right?
There's also that. Maybe you should read about
math.
Math
and you
novels.
Get it all.
Then you get it all in one. You know what? That's our last story for tonight. How about we do a website of the week?
Let's do it. And And our website of the week this week is phdinparenting.com.
This is a blog by a mom who she's thinking about not just the art of parenting, but she's trying to bring in the science behind it as well. So she does present some research-based information. A lot of the material that she presents in her blog is from her own life and from her own experience, and it's her own opinions too. But it's certainly, it seems to me a while back, this was a site that was nominated as a very controversial blog. So she's often the information that she presents really gets you thinking, and certainly there's lots of discussions there and feedback on her posts. So there's tons and tons of information. She's been around, I think she started around the same time that we did. I'm not sure.
And it sounds like, she's a mom herself.
Yeah.
And part of the reason she started the blog is just to have a forum for herself to sort of think through ideas and to really give herself an opportunity to go through that thinking process that you do when you're first a parent. And of course, she's hoping that other people will contribute and look at her blog and get ideas from it as well. But I mean, she's trying to help herself. She's trying to help others through the parenting process, which is complicated and which has a lot of ups and downs and fun. Yeah. And you know, struggles and so on.
Yeah.
And so it makes for an interesting site.
And in fact, this is somebody, she's from near where we are, and we actually had an opportunity to meet her. Oh, when did we meet her? It was a few months ago, in the spring,
it was,
I think.
Yes.
Yeah, we met her in the spring. So we've had a chance to talk back and forth. We sent some emails back and forth a few times, and we met up in person once, but very nice. And she's got a lot of interesting information. And even if you disagree with the posts, they're going to make you think and maybe make you and encourage you maybe to talk about some of these issues with your partner.
That's it.
So our website of the week is phdinparenting.com. And you can find her also on Twitter. She's at twitter.com/phdinparenting. And that's our website of the week.
And that's our show for this week. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com, and you can email us at info@familyanatomy.com. And as always, Dr. Brian has an announcement.
How about this? The month's almost done. Podcast Alley is about to reset their votes. It's going to be October 1st very soon. So how about popping over to familyanatomy.com/vote, and you can help to keep Family Anatomy the number one kids and family podcast on Podcast Alley. familyanatomy.com/vote. And that's our show for this week. As usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
FamilyAnatomy.com